Today on Inside Politics, what future are Americans more afraid of? Both Donald Trump and Joe Biden tried to win votes on what Americans are most worried about. Trump stokes fears of American carnage at the hands of migrants, while Biden warns of an America where abortion is unavailable and health care is at risk. Plus, Joe Biden puts out a blistering statement after the Israeli government apologizes for unintentionally killing aid workers. But some fellow Democrats say words are no longer enough. And the special counsel does something remarkable. He puts pen to paper, blasting the judge presiding over the classified documents case for what he views as making basic mistakes that may cost him at trial. I'm Dana Bash. Let's go behind the headlines and inside politics. Up first, Donald Trump is betting that he can scare voters on what he calls migrant crime into choosing him in November.
But I stand before you today to declare that Joe Biden's border bloodbath, and that's what it is. It's a bloodbath. They tried to use that term incorrectly on me 2 weeks ago. You know, it's all about misinformation. That's all they do is cheat on elections and disinformation, misinformation, fairly closely related, those two words. It's a border bloodbath, and it's destroying our country. It's a very bad thing happening.
Let's get straight to CNN's Elena Treen. Elena.
Well, Dana, this is clearly messaging that Trump is going to continue to use as he moves closer to November. He's leaning into his inflammatory, incendiary, and quite frankly, violent rhetoric to play on voters' fears about immigrants. And I do want to be clear about what he's trying to do, because it's the same type of strategy we saw him use successfully in his 2016 campaign. He's using dehumanizing language to describe undocumented immigrants as violent criminals, even though available data does not support the idea that migrants are contributing to increases in crime. And he's doing this really to drive home his point that Biden isn't protecting Americans with the way that he is handling the southern border. Take a listen to what he said yesterday.
This is country changing, it's country threatening, and it's country wrecking. They have wrecked our country. We will stop the plunder, rape, slaughter, and destruction of our American suburbs, cities, and towns. The Treasury will be raped, plundered, and robbed bare to pay for welfare, free health care, free housing, food stamps, Medicaid. I will end the carnage, bloodshed, and killing.
Now, Dana, he's clearly trying to paint this doomsday picture of America. And it also gets into how he framed his remarks yesterday. His campaign had labeled that first event in Michigan as, quote, Biden's border bloodbath. Again, their words. And it's a play on the language that Trump received immense backlash for just a few weeks ago when he used the term bloodbath to describe the state of the auto industry and the country if Biden were to win in November. Now, part of his strategy yesterday as well, which we have seen Trump deploy on the trail before, is to use specific stories of people who were killed by migrants who have entered the country illegally. Trump has really seized on these high-profile crimes involving immigrants to try to make inroads in key battleground states. And I do think it's also important to point out here that this is the fear-mongering that we're seeing is working. Polling shows that immigration and the border is a top issue for voters in several states, including those like Michigan and Wisconsin that are hundreds of miles away from the southern border.
Yeah, and we just saw it play big in a New York special election, also not very close to the southern border. Thank you so much for that. Appreciate it. And while, as we just heard from Elena's report, Trump is making immigration, again, the cornerstone of his campaign, President Biden is hoping the election is about something else. Health care, abortion rights. This morning, he is at the White House. He's actually speaking right now about what his administration has done on health care issues, specifically to lower the cost of prescription drugs. We're going to monitor the president as he speaks. In the meantime, I want to bring in my great panel to discuss all of this. CNN's Priscilla Alvarez, Dave Weigel of Semaphore, and Bloomberg and CNN's Nia Malika Henderson. Nia, how do you see this as different from 2020 with regard to the framing of these issues? I don't think Trump is very different. How about Biden, aside from the obvious that Roe wasn't overturned.
Yeah, listen, I think we have seen in this post-Roe world this be an issue that really works for Democrats. And you see Biden trying to lean into what's happening in Florida, what's happening all over the country. Donald Trump is now kind of has his back against the wall, right? He's talked about a 15-week ban. He's talked about a 16-week ban. He now says that he is going to say something about this next week. We'll see if it's different than whatever else he said. But you can see the Democrats really wanting to tie him in on the reality where we live now, which is the Dobbs America, where there is a patchwork of abortion rights and restrictions in many, many states. And so we'll see what happens. You know, I think with Trump, he is very much the Trump of 2016, right, with all the rhetoric and fear-mongering. And you have Democrats trying to say that abortion is part of a kind of radical agenda that Trump and Republicans will bring to America. I don't think they hit that strongly enough all the time. I think that is, I think, the goal for them. And you saw that work, I think, in other elections, particularly in 2022.
And Dave, I want to bring up part of your piece today, or maybe it was yesterday, but it really goes on to explain this bloodbath line from Donald Trump. Trump has been warning about migrant crime and telling gruesome murder stories since he entered the 2016 presidential campaign. What's new this year, as seen in the bloodbath messaging reboot, is the confidence that doing this will cost him nothing with non-white voters. That is so interesting. I want you to talk about that, and also something we see often from Trump, which is taking a term that Democrats, the Biden campaign, used to say, look how horrible he is. He used the word bloodbath and trying to turn it on its head and apply it to his opponent.
Right, which Trump started basically 48 hours after he made those bloodbath remarks, after the Biden campaign started to attack. They released a video saying this, and this is also important for 2024, every Republican who commented on the issue was using the same language. Chip Roy, who didn't even want to vote for Trump in the primary, talked about Biden's border bloodbath. And Republicans across the country, I point out in the piece that Kelly Ayotte, running for governor of New Hampshire, couldn't even bring herself to support Trump in 2016, is now running almost every day on the threat of quote unquote migrant crime. And so the entire party moved his direction. And that was really what changed in 2020, because he improved in South Texas and South Florida, because Hialeah, Florida, they have a road named after Trump, because he seemed to lose nothing with Latino voters by talking this way, it became safe for everyone in the party to talk about it politically from their view.
Well, 30,000 foot view here, there's a candidate that talks about things in violent terms, and there's a candidate that doesn't. That's where we see a lot of this rhetoric. Now, when it comes to the use of bloodbath and migrant crime, et cetera, and Latino voters, ultimately, in talking to voters and going to some of these, the president's rallies, they want solutions. They kind of glaze over the rhetoric. It is alarming to them, but they want to see a solution. Something that former President Donald Trump said was, every state is a border state. He's been saying that for a while. A lot of Republicans have been saying that for a while. But frankly, they see it in a way that they didn't before. People are seeing it in Denver, in New York City, in Washington, D.C., in Philadelphia. So you have these constituencies who are laying eyes on migrants in a way that they frankly didn't before. And so they see this as mismanaged, they see it as a problem. So while they take issue with the rhetoric, they ultimately want to see the White House provide some sort of solution. And in the absence of that, they also don't disagree with they don't agree with the way that Democrats and the president are handling the issue.
And they're seeing it in large part, and I think we can't say this enough, because of what the Texas governor, Greg Abbott, did.
Right.
Politically successfully, never mind the actual policy, but politically, he has had great success in sending migrants to blue cities, blue states. You said that people who you talk to at Biden events want solutions. Let's talk about a new Wall Street Journal poll, which comes up with a lot of the very important issues that voters are likely to go to the polls about, and ranks them when it comes to Trump versus Biden. The economy, Trump is up by 20. Immigration, not surprisingly, Trump is up by 20. Abortion, plus 12. Protecting democracy,
shocking.
Biden, Well, is it shocking? Because it's only plus one. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking that he is only up by plus one against a guy who tried to overthrow democracy very violently on January 6th. And this is something that Democrats have been hitting. Biden has given several speeches on this. They see this as a centerpiece of their efforts to get moderate voters, independent voters, suburban women voters, some of those Nikki Haley voters as well. And the idea that Biden is only up by one, I think, is fairly shocking. The other number's not too shocking, right? Mm-hmm. You think about the economy, you talk to voters, they do sincerely believe that the economy was better under Donald Trump. And this is, for decades, I think most voters have thought that Republicans more generally were better on the economy. And so, but that Democratic number, you know, who's better with supporting democracy is pretty shocking.
Well, and it's alarming too, because it's a central tenet of the Biden campaign is protecting democracy. That is how he launched his re-election bid. And so that's what they're banking on in addition to abortion. So if economy and immigration continue to stack so high, then that also requires, you know, the campaign to try to frame those issues.
Let's look at some of the battleground states that the Wall Street Journal polled. North Carolina, Trump is up by six. Arizona, Trump is up. Nevada, Trump is up by four. Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia. Obviously, you see it goes in descending order. Wisconsin, where Trump was yesterday, tied.
Right. And if you keep looking at that poll, 51% of people across those states have a positive view of how Trump governed as president.
Yeah, we have that. Let's put that up.
Yeah, that is what the Biden campaign is fighting against. And they have got the rest of the year to try to change this. But there is a preponderance of views in the electorate that things were better when Trump was president. And every day with what you see the Biden campaign doing, especially on social media, literally flashing back 4 years ago and saying, remember this COVID press conference? Remember this thing that didn't work out? Remember this Trump statement? They're trying to do that. I'm not sure it's reaching the sort of voters who skip midterms, skip specials, but vote in every election. I'm not sure it's reaching them. That is their argument. Literally remember what happened four years ago.
And it's not just on social media. Yeah. We're hearing more from senior members of the Biden administration, including the First Lady. Listen to what she said this morning.
Oh, he's not losing in all the battlefields. He's coming up and he's even or doing better. So you know what? Once people start to focus in and they see their two choices, it's obvious that Joe will win this election.
You know, you hear that a lot from campaign officials when it comes to these polling numbers. Wait until we get closer. What does it really mean now? Even the way that he brings in surrogates, former President Barack Obama really isn't expected to play in until after Labor Day. So their sights are certainly set on September, October, when they expect voters are going to be paying more attention. But in the meantime, it's all about messaging and reminding and seeing where that gets them.
Yeah. I just want to, before we move on to a different part of our conversation, look at crime, because that really is the crux of where we started this segment about what Donald Trump is doing and claiming that crime is bad and saying that it's all about migrants. But even beyond that, look at what the FBI tells us. Hard facts, hard numbers. Murder, rape, burglary, violent crime, aggravated assault. They're all down.
Yeah.
And that was the fourth quarter of 2023, so not that long.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the problem that Democrats have is that there have been these high-profile crimes, right? Random killings of folks, and you have in Donald Trump somebody who wants to amplify them. When he went to Michigan, for instance, he was talking about a crime, a murder of a woman there, and so that's the problem. Numbers don't really combat people's fear and emotions, and we know that Donald Trump is so good at stoking them.
You totally set me up for something that I want to report now, which is at his rally last night in Michigan, Trump highlighted the case of Ruby Garcia, a Michigan woman who was allegedly murdered by an undocumented immigrant she was in a romantic relationship with. Let's listen.
They said she had just this most contagious laughter, and when she walked into a room, she lit up that room. And I've heard that from so many people. I spoke to some of her family.
Garcia's sister said that never happened. She told a local TV station that Trump and his campaign have not contacted her or other relatives and slammed his effort to make her sister's case part of his campaign. No comment yet from the Trump campaign. Now, coming up next, brand new White House reaction to yesterday's Israeli strike that killed 7 aid workers. Stay with us.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
President Biden expressing outrage over an Israeli airstrike that the IDF says unintentionally killed 7 aid workers. But the administration is also making clear today that does not mean the president is easing up on support for Israel's goal, eliminating the Hamas terror group.
While we make no bones about the fact that we have certain issues about some of the way things are being done, we also make no bones about the fact that Israel is going to continue to have American support for the fight that they're in to eliminate the threat from Hamas.
That after a remarkable moment inside the White House last night, a meeting meant as outreach to Muslim American leaders was interrupted when a Palestinian American doctor walked out of a meeting with the president of the United States. He explained his decision to my colleague Caitlin Collins.
It was very brief comments by the president saying he wants to hear from us and he wants to listen to us. And so I spoke first and I let him know that I am from a community that's reeling. We are grieving. Our heart is broken out of respect for my community, out of respect for all of the people who have suffered and who have been killed in the process. I need to walk out of the meeting and I want to walk out with decision makers and let them know what it feels like for somebody to say something and then walk away from them and not hear them out.
I want to talk more with the panel here about this. Dave Weigel, we have seen at virtually every event that President Biden has done and other members of the administration, protesters come in recently. This is next level. Mm-hmm. It's inside the White House, a meeting with the president of invited guests. And this was obviously an intentional form of protest, but quite different from just somebody getting into a public event.
Right. Yes. And Dr. Ahmed's the whole campaign, the whole ceasefire campaign has been very willing to work with the media. Dr. Ahmed was working with media, communicating really almost minutes after this walkout happened. There is basically two factions to this movement. I can't say how big one or the other is. One that is done with Joe Biden, is not going to vote for him, is urging people to abandon the ticket completely. One that is trying to change policy by any means necessary. This kind of protest, I think there were at least five people who paid money to be at the fundraiser in New York last week who interrupted. And they want to change policy, in their words, before it's too late. This is 6 months, this coming weekend, since the war began. They're arguing that you cannot win, Joe Biden cannot win the election unless he changes policy. And they're being very forward in how they say this to the press.
Yeah, I mean, listen, this is part of the beauty of America, that people have an opportunity to either just outright protest or try to change policy. And again, it's pretty remarkable that one of the protests got this close of an audience with the president to do it in private that way. Jose Andres, who of course is the founder of World Central Kitchen, the organization that was in Gaza trying to help feed them, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times today, reading in part, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said of the Israeli killings of our team, it happens in war. It was a direct attack on clearly marked vehicles whose movements were known by the Israeli Defense Forces. It was also a direct result of a policy that squeezed humanitarian aid to desperate levels. What are you hearing behind the scenes at the White House about how this incident, this horrific tragedy, might have changed things? I will just say that I have heard that in discussions that they are having with Israel, that it's changed things there, that this was an accident, it was unintentional, and that they're thinking through different ways of prosecuting the war.
There has been simmering tensions. There have been simmering frustrations. This really raised the frustration held by President Biden and his top aides that this incident happened. And that was very clear in his statement yesterday. He used the term outrage. That is one of the strongest terms that the White House has used in talking about Israel's war against Hamas, and they made clear, and the National Security Council spokesperson this morning also made clear that they were frustrated by it, that they don't agree that it was the right thing to do, that too many innocent civilians are dying and there's not enough humanitarian aid going in. But as you mentioned there at the top, that does not change their posture that they still support Israel. There are incidents, however, that just go too far. And of course, what's looming over all of this is that Rafah operation and whether Israel decides to move forward with that. So far, they haven't really budged. An Israeli delegation is expected to still come to Washington in the coming week to further discuss this. But it just goes to show that these moments can really just fuel this concern within the White House and the administration.
I want you to listen to what Senator Bernie Sanders said. He said it yesterday. Actually, he's at the White House right now on health care policy, but this just kind of gives a sense of the kind of pressure that President Biden is getting.
Israel does not have the right to kill, to create a situation where they're stopping humanitarian aid from getting in. The result of it is children are starving to death right now. Do we want to be complicit in that? The answer, in my view, is most Americans, and what the polling shows us, most Americans do not want to be complicit. If your question is it going to hurt the president unless he turns this around? Yeah, it will.
Listen, I mean, he sounds like a lot of Democrats who are showing their displeasure in some of these primaries. We've seen they're basically voting against Joe Biden explicitly because of this policy around Gaza, around the war that Israel is prosecuting. And I think the real question about this incident is it clearly took sort of Westerners to die for it to be raised to this level. There's something like 30,000 Palestinians who've been killed in this effort. I think one big question is does this change things? Well, you say it changes things in terms of the IDF's prosecution of the war.
Maybe.
Possibly.
Yeah.
We'll see if this sort of changes the world stance.
Although I will say, I mean, obviously, even before this, there was the protests have gotten much more robust. And that's playing out on the electoral map at the ballot box. Just quickly, in Wisconsin last night, we did see on the Democratic side, the Democratic presidential primary, obviously Biden won overwhelmingly, but something called uninstructed, which is effectively a protest vote, got 8.3%. I don't want to lose sight of the fact that there was also a protest vote on the Republican side. Donald Trump doesn't have an opponent anymore. He got 78.9%. Nikki Haley got 12.7%, and Ron DeSantis got some too.
Right. And this is that faction I was talking about that want to remain involved in the process, that are urging people stay involved in the Democratic primary, stay involved in the party. You can change the president. The numbers are actually higher in Connecticut and Rhode Island, where the option of protesting Biden was on the ballot. It got double digits in both states, very low double digits. But that understates how much opposition there is in the Democratic base. The Gallup's polling in the last week showed we're down to about less than a quarter of Democrats who agree with the way Israel's prosecuting the war in Gaza. I don't think there's any issue that Biden's running on right now or defending right now where he's this separated from his base. Not abortion, not the economy, not immigration, none of that. This is the biggest problem for him within the party, not just with voters in Dearborn or Arab Americans walking out of the White House, with most Democrats. They are very unhappy with how Israel's prosecuted the war. It's changed completely from November, when a lot of Democrats were scared to talk about it.
Thank you, guys. What a great discussion. I learned a lot. Appreciate it. Up next, the special counsel disses the judge handling the classified documents case and threatens to go over her head. Plus, with friends like these, Marjorie Taylor Greene says the Republican speaker is doing the dirty work of the deep state. Hell hath no fury like a special counsel scorned. Late last night, Jack Smith hit send on a page-turner. As far as legal documents go, Smith put all of his frustrations with Judge Eileen Cannon down in a court filing. His annoyance that there is still no firm trial date for the classified documents case, that her jury instructions seem dramatically tilted toward the former president, that she seemingly accepts lies from Trump's defense as fact. Smith and his team vent openly that the judge, quote, legal premise is wrong, so much so that premise would distort the trial. Yet she has not scheduled this trial yet. CNN's Paula Reed and Ellie Honig join our conversation. Paul, I'm just going to read one more bit of this filing. He said, it would be pure fiction to suggest that highly classified documents created by members of the intelligence community and military and presented to the President of the United States during his term in office were, quote, purely private. Now, that is about the substance. But it seems to me that his biggest frustration is with the process.
Yeah, and the judge specifically. I mean, she is an inexperienced judge. She's a Trump appointee. She's only been on the bench for a few years now. She's never handled a case like this. And look, Dana, even giving her credit for the fact that this is an unprecedented criminal case, a lot of her decisions have come under considerable scrutiny, you know, like this one, asking both sides to give instructions for a jury for an eventual trial related to an act that he hasn't been charged under. Highly unusual. And it's a series of unusual decisions that she has made in and around this case.
And Ellie, the biggest issue, well, one of the big issues that the special counsel has is the delay and the feeling clearly that the judge is playing into the defense strategy, which is to delay it so that it reaches November and then we have the election and then maybe poof, it goes away. Do you have any sense that as part of that, he is setting the stage for a motion to get rid of the judge?
So Jack Smith clearly has had it with Judge Eileen Cannon. I think that oozes out of this briefing. As you said, it's quite a sensational filing from a prosecutor. I do think there is some frustration that's obvious with the pace of this as well as the substance of it. Now, one move that Jack Smith could make here, and he sort of alludes to it in the briefing, is A, if the judge sticks by this ruling, if the judge says, I am going to instruct the jury on this Presidential Records Act defense, then Jack Smith makes clear, I will appeal that and I will appeal it now. The other thing that Jack Smith might do is ask the appeals court to remove Judge Cannon from the case. Now, that's quite a drastic step. It is very rarely, not never, but very rarely taken by prosecutors, and there's no assurance that they win. But the sort of irony of all of this is if Jack Smith appeals this and if Jack Smith asks the appeals court to remove Judge Cannon, that will delay this more than anything that's happened so far.
And Paula, you have actually spent time, unlike maybe Ellie has, I certainly haven't had a chance to, in a lot of the courtrooms that Donald Trump and his legal team have been on various cases that he's facing right now. When it comes to Eileen Cannon, you mentioned that she's inexperienced. Let me just give a little bit of her background here. She was appointed by Donald Trump just in 2020. She's been a Federalist Society member since 2005. No experience presiding over classified cases. What's it like being in the courtroom with her?
So when I was in the courtroom, what struck me is she's obviously very conscious of the fact that she is under enormous scrutiny. She knows that. She clearly comes prepared with tough questions for both sides to at least give the appearance, right, of being fair to everyone. But her inexperience shows through. I'm just talking about when you're in the courtroom, when the special counsel's office and Trump's lawyers, as they are known to do, sort of get into it and start getting a little petty. Keeping the control of her courtroom is something that she didn't demonstrate. Such a contrast to, for example, Judge Tanya Chutkan, who oversees the other special counsel case here in D.C. She's been on the bench for 10 years. She's not having any of it. She's able to keep things moving along very quickly and keep her courtroom under control. And then you see sort of what comes through in the filings or the lack thereof. I mean, Eileen Cannon still has over a dozen very significant motions and issues hanging out there. And based on what I've seen in the courtroom, based on what we've seen in the filings, it appears that in some ways she's maybe just almost too afraid to make some of these decisions, understanding how much scrutiny she is under.
Is it afraid or is it deliberate? That is really one of the questions. And Ellie, I want to bring you back in here just to remind people, it has been 34 days since Cannon held a hearing on scheduling the Mar-a-Lago documents trial. We thought maybe we would hear very shortly after that announcement 34 days ago on when the trial would be. And here we are.
Yeah, Dan, I think the chances of this case being tried before the election are now approaching zero. Even Jack Smith is acknowledging there's no way this case will be tried in May as it was originally scheduled. I agree with Paula. I think the issue here is the judge's inexperience. I actually disagree with a narrative that's out there that Judge Cannon is somehow in the bag or pulling for Trump because she could have dismissed this charges. She actually rejected an argument by Donald Trump that these charges should be dismissed outright. But I do think that as Judge Cannon's realizing now, it's not easy to manage these cases. It takes experience. You have to juggle a lot of different motions. They're complicated. You have to get a lot done. And I also agree with Paula that Judge Chutkan in D.C., who's more experienced, both as a judge and in the courtroom, is showing much more command of the facts in the case in front of her. So look, inexperience is a real issue here, and I think she's learning on the fly, and it's probably not the ideal scenario for that.
Paula, Ellie, two of my favorite lawyers, and that says a lot. I know a lot of lawyers. I live in Washington. Coming up, a liar and a damn fool. That's how a fellow Republican is describing House Speaker Mike Johnson. Manu Raju is going to be here after the break to tell us about that. You got to hear it next.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Mike Johnson is not working for Republicans. He's not helping Republicans. He's not even listening to Republicans. That is from a fellow Republican, Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's saying that about the House Speaker as she's demanding again that he be replaced. CNN's Manu Raju has been following all of this drama on Capitol Hill. So, Manu, she filed the potential of taking him out of the speaker's chair before they went away for recess. Then it sounded like she was kind of not going to act on that. And now has she changed her mind again? What's going on?
It's unclear exactly the timing of all of this. Remember, just one member could call for the ouster of a sitting speaker if they decide to do that on the floor of the House. The House returns into session next week. We'll see if she decides to take a step then or if she will wait. But this kind of rhetoric would seem unthinkable years ago. Going one member of the conference attacking publicly the leader of their conference, let alone the Speaker of the House. But that has become commonplace in this bitterly divided House Republican majority in the aftermath of the ouster of Kevin McCarthy last fall. At that time, Marjorie Taylor Greene was aligned with Kevin McCarthy, but this time much different with Mike Johnson and over his deal cutting to keep the government open, his handling of that issue, which propelled her to warn him that she actually may push him out of office. And speaking to Steve Bannon yesterday, she made clear that she may very well go ahead with this push.
He is not working for Republicans. He is not helping Republicans. He's not even listening to Republicans. He is doing the very dirty work of the deep state. For Mike Johnson to actually think that his Republican conference supports sending $60 billion to Ukraine, he is a damn fool, Steve.
Hold on. And that last point, so critical, because Mike Johnson right now is weighing how to proceed with funding for Ukraine, emergency aid for Ukraine. Of course, this has been stalled in Congress for months. The Senate has already acted on a separate Ukraine package. Now Johnson is trying to figure out if there's something that could get Republican support. But if you heard right there from Marjorie Taylor Greene warning him not to move ahead on Ukraine aid. But if she does decide to push him out, the question will be too, Dana, what do Democrats do? Do they decide to save him? And some of them say there's a price to saving him, and that's Ukraine aid.
I'm so glad you said that. We've almost become numb to rhetoric like this from Republicans like Marjorie Taylor Greene against their leaders, even their speakers. And it is not normal or usual. Manu, I have to also ask about two members of the House who just disclosed that they are battling some serious health issues. What can you tell us?
Yeah, Raul Grijalva, he's an Arizona Democrat, a longtime Democrat, just announced that he has cancer. He is 76 years old. His office says that he is battling this and that he is going to try to make a recovery through this after being discovered that he does have cancer. And also Lauren Boebert, she's much younger, 37 years old, but she just had underwent a emergency surgery for a blood clot in her leg. And of course, this underscores the fragility of this narrowly divided House Republican conference. It's unclear when Boebert will return, although her office says she is expected to make a full recovery. Dana.
Manu, thank you so much for that. Appreciate it. Up next, President Biden confronts demands from families who want to see their loved ones brought home. Loved ones who are still being held hostage almost 6 months later by Hamas in Gaza. Stay with us. 180 days. That's how long Israeli hostages have been held captive in Gaza since the October 7th Hamas attack. That includes at least six American citizens. Today, in a powerful demonstration of frustration, family members of hostages stormed the public gallery of the Knesset, Israel's parliament. Opposition members can be heard echoing their chant now. Here in the U.S., Jewish groups are demanding more help from the White House. I'm joined now by Rabbi Moshe Hauer of the Orthodox Union. He is leading an effort to deliver 180,000 letters to the White House today, urging the president to continue to stand with Israel and to demand the hostages be released. Thank you so much for joining me. You said when you came to get ready that you believe that those 180,000 letters have been delivered, or they're being delivered
right now. They're on their way right now. They're being delivered as we speak.
Now, I want to read part of the letter. It says, April 3rd, 2024, which is today, marks 180 days since that black day. 180 days of the unimaginable torture of those held hostage in Gaza. Please continue to stand strong with Israel. It's the right thing to do today, and it will be long remembered. Talk about your goal here.
Our goal is to have the moral voice, the moral clarity of President Biden and the administration, which has been a critical, critical piece of support for Israel and clarity for the world since October 7th. The world has misunderstood. The forums for resolving difficulties amongst nations like the United Nations still doesn't even acknowledge the reality of the rape and brutalization of the women that happened in the hands of Hamas. They have still not been able to come together to condemn their action. Now, the president has been a strong voice standing up for what's true and what's right, focusing on the true humanitarian, most basic humanitarian issue here, which is the hostages. Mm-hmm. Today, the amount of time and words that are spent on humanitarian issues are vastly disproportionate around the ambiguous question of, well, how much aid is getting in? Israel's working to get it in. Israel's struggling on that. The story of these hostages is unambiguous, and yet it's being negotiated. Innocent children for murderers with blood on their hands. We're trying to ask the president to restore moral clarity.
Let me ask you about that. You use the term moral clarity because 180, 18, I don't need to tell you, in Hebrew is chai, which means life. And in the Jewish faith, every life matters. And there is a contradiction between that belief and some of what we are seeing and we know to be happening with regard to the retaliation and Palestinian civilians, many of whom are our children, and they're not Hamas terrorists. They're being killed or starving. How do you, as a faith leader, as a Jewish leader, square that with the other bit of moral clarity, as you said, which is the need to destroy Hamas and also get those hostages back when it comes to a life?
Yes. So we absolutely, chai is not just a convenient, beautiful word or an emblem for a necklace. Chai, the value of life, cherishing life is a core value of our people. And we feel that it is perfectly on display. President Biden expressed yesterday that he was outraged and heartbroken over what happened to the workers of the World Central Kitchen. Every Jew, every Israeli is equally heartbroken over what happened to them. And that's why in Israel today, yesterday, there's investigation. There's figuring out how to do it better. There's figuring out how this, which was essentially a friendly fire incident, which doesn't just kill aid workers or innocent Palestinians, but has killed many soldiers.
But what about
And Palestinians? Absolutely. The Israeli army is working with an ethic of trying in creative ways, unprecedented ways in modern warfare and in a situation which Hamas has created the impossibility of being able to separate them out by what they've done, to try to preserve life. Recognize that Israel is grieving over the loss, of innocent civilians, Hamas is celebrating it as part of their strategy. They're not grieving over the death of the aid workers. The death of the aid workers makes their case better because it makes Israel look bad. They have put themselves to put citizens in harm's way. That's the difference between a culture of chai, a culture that celebrates life, that is trying to preserve life. Of course, there's a primary value, a priority that every society, including Jewish, has. We have to preserve our own lives, and we have an incredible value on trying to preserve the lives of others.
Rabbi Moshe Hauer of the Orthodox Union, thank you so much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining Inside Politics. CNN News Central starts after a quick break.